Van Halen is or was an American rock band who brought the rock and roll scene to a whole new level back in the late 1970s. You may or may not have a clue who Van Halen is, and that's certainly okay. Whatever you may think of them as a group, whatever you may think of their music, whatever you may think of their original lead singer, David Lee Roth, they blazed a new trail in a variety of ways. For example, Van Halen's contract insisted that a bowl of M&Ms be provided backstage. Now, there's nothing particularly unusual about that. For example, the Rolling Stones require the promoter to install a snooker table, similar to a pool table, backstage at every concert. But Van Halen's contract insisted that a bowl of M&Ms be provided backstage, but with every single brown M&M removed. And if the band arrived and saw only a single brown M&M in the bowl, they could cancel the concert and still receive full payment. Sounds silly, maybe, but Van Halen had a good reason to include that in their contract. And it had nothing to do with the M&Ms per se. David Lee Roth explains it this way. He said, Van Halen was the first band to take huge productions into third level markets. We'd pull up with 9 18-wheelers full of gear, where the standard band used 3 trucks maximum. And there were many, many technical errors, whether it was the girders couldn't support the weight, or the flooring would sink in, or the doors weren't big enough to move the gear through. The contract writer read like the yellow pages, he said, because there was so much equipment and so many human beings needed to make it function. So we buried a little test in the middle of the contract. Article 126, the no brown M&Ms clause. Ross says, when I would walk backstage, if I saw a brown M&M in that bowl, we would line check the entire production. It was guaranteed that you'd run into a problem. Because if they overlooked that detail, then there's a good chance that they overlooked some other details. And the mistakes, he said, could be life-threatening. For example, in Colorado, the band found that the local promoters had failed to read the weight requirements and that the staging would have fallen through the arena floor. You can hear a discussion between the promoter and his foreman. Anything unusual in that contract? Well, they must really like M&Ms because there's a clause in there that says they want a huge bowl of M&Ms backstage. You never know what to expect from some of these bands. It's not about the M&Ms, it's about the details, the specifics. When people are not committed to the main principle, when their commitment is not first and foremost the desire to honor the contract, they will most likely fail in keeping the details. There's a principle here that has application to serving the Lord. The Pharisees burdened themselves with countless tasks. Mark 7, verses 1 through 4 tells us that the Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. The Pharisees, he explains, and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash, and they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles. And, of course, in their efforts to get all the details right, their service ultimately ended up being little more than a list of do's and don'ts. And the Pharisees inevitably missed the big picture. Matthew 23, verses 1 through 4, Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must be careful to do everything they tell you, but do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy, cumbersome loads and put them on other people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Then we pick up down in verse 16 where Jesus continues his scathing rebuke of them. Matthew 23:16-23. Woe to you, blind guides, you who say if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing, but anyone who swears by the gold of the temple is bound by that oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also say, if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing. But anyone who swears by the gift on the altar is bound by that oath. You blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore, anyone who swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. And anyone who swears by the temple swears by it and by the one who dwells in it. And anyone who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law: justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. Like the Pharisees, some people saddle themselves with burdens, then wonder why they find serving the Lord so burdensome. There are things that we should do, but when we make the list our focus, instead of making the heart of the matter our focus, we end up like the Pharisees. In Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14, we're told that Jesus told a parable to some who were confident of their own righteousness and they looked down on everyone else. He said, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance, and he would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Jesus said, I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Now, to make it clear, I'm not saying that all we need to do is love God. I'm saying that if we keep our focus on loving God, then keeping the other things will flow from that. In Matthew 22, verses 35 through 40, we're told that an expert in the law tested Jesus with this question. He said, Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus replied, Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And then he says, the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. Jesus said that the main thing, first and foremost, is to love God. Then notice what the Apostle John said in 1 John 5, verse 3. This is love for God, to keep his commands. And his commands are not burdensome. If we make loving God our focus, then keeping his commands will be the natural outgrowth of that. But if we make keeping his commands the central focus, then loving God becomes a burden. The more we focus on the list, the more difficult it becomes to love the Lord. The Christians in Corinth had a tendency to elevate teachers and preachers. They were factious. They tended to choose a certain teacher and follow him. This caused divisions. It caused a party atmosphere. It promoted an atmosphere of splitting into cliques, little groups where you're loyal to the leader of the group and to each other more so than others around you. And the more your devotion is centered on the leader of the group, the less your devotion is centered on the Lord. Paul points out that he and the other apostles and preachers were simply servants and stewards. They were not to be elevated in some way. If you have your Bible, I invite you to turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 4. In context, Paul is talking about himself, Apollos, and the apostle Peter, whom he calls Cephas. From chapter 3, verse 22, that's the connection there. And then in chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, 1 Corinthians 4, 1 and 2, Paul says, this is how one should regard us, instead of elevating us, instead of putting us against one another, seeking someone to follow. This is how one should regard us. You should regard us as ministers or as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found faithful. The word translated ministers or servants here is literally the word under rowers. It describes the slaves who rowed the huge Roman galley ships. Paul is saying that like everyone else, he and the other apostles and preachers held no higher rank in the kingdom than any other slave of God. Paul was saying, we are not the captains of the ship. We are merely the galley slaves who are following the orders of the captain. Paul says that he and the other apostles and preachers were simply servants. And then he adds another word. He says there in verses 1 and 2 that they were stewards. He says, this is how one should regard us as ministers or servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found faithful. A steward is one who manages or looks after another's property, property that belongs to someone else. A steward is a servant who manages everything for his master, but who himself owns none of that. Paul knew his place. He recognized that he was merely a slave and that his role was simply to be faithful to his master. Now, if the apostles were merely slaves and stewards, where does that leave us? And I realize that in context, Paul is talking about a specific stewardship regarding the revealing of the gospel message. But all of us are merely slaves and stewards in that everything we have belongs to God. We don't run the ship. We're not in control of anything in that regard. Paul says that if you want to serve the Lord, then just faithfully do the things God puts before you each day. Just reliably do what he tells you to do. Concentrate on becoming the person he wants you to be as you live your life daily. That means we must resist trying to control everything. Our place is merely to take orders from the one who's in charge. Jesus said in Matthew 11, 28 through 30, take my yoke upon you, learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. That begins verse 29, rather. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. If our yoke is going to be easy, and if our burden is going to be light, then we must resist taking control to ourselves. And we must relinquish control to the Lord. And I'm talking about controlling, trying to control everything in our lives, trying to control others, trying to control what's going on around us. And that should relieve some pressure. We can avoid the headaches of trying to control everything and everybody while we simply focus on doing our duty and leaving the results up to the Lord. Then in 1 Corinthians 4, verses 3 through 6, Paul says, I care very little if I am judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait until the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of the heart. At that time, each will receive their praise from God. Now, brothers and sisters, I have applied these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, so that you may learn from us the meaning of the saying, do not go beyond what is written. Then you will not be puffed up in being a follower of one of us over against the other. Paul understood that others were incapable of judging him. He understood that he was incapable of judging himself. But we can be completely oblivious to glaring flaws and inconsistencies that others can easily see in us. He said, I know nothing of myself worthy of condemnation, if you will. But others might have a different view of that. There can be a fine line between a clear conscience and a self-righteous attitude. So we must beware. I read about someone who told about a young preacher who once requested prayers from this individual. He was talking to him privately, and he asked him to pray for him. He's addressing his future as a preacher. The young man said, please pray for me that I will stay humble. Now, there's nothing wrong with requesting prayers. There's nothing wrong with requesting a prayer to be humble. But apparently, this individual detected some arrogance at the root of the request. And so the man's response was, tell me, what do you have to be proud about? In certain circumstances, we can get caught up in our own self-importance. When former President Ronald Reagan was a teenager in Dixon, Illinois, he had a summer job as a lifeguard on the Rock River. One day, from his elevated perch at Lowell Park, Reagan noticed one of Dixon's most popular girls waving at him. At least I thought she was waving, he goes on to say. He recalled, he said, my chest puffed out a little and I waved back. Then I turned away for a moment, but when I looked back again, she was going down. She'd been trying to signal for help. She wasn't waving. Paul was aware of men's inability to accurately see themselves and to see others. He knew that only the Lord was capable of judging mankind. He said in verse 7, what do you have that God hasn't given you? And if everything you have is from God, why boast as though it were not a gift? Denzel Washington was speaking to a group of young actors, and he said, I pray that you all put your shoes way under the bed at night so that you've got to get on your knees in the morning when you wake up to find them. And while you're down there, he said, thank God for grace and mercy and understanding. We all fall short of the glory. But if you just start thinking about all the things you got to say thank you for, that's a day. That's easily a day. He went on to say, now, I've been blessed to make hundreds of millions of dollars in my life. I can't take it with me, and neither can you. It's not how much you have, it's what you do with what you have. And we all have different gifts, some money, some love, some patience, some the ability to touch people, but we all have it. Use it, share it. That's what counts. Because you'll never see a U-Haul behind a hearse. We typically think we know what's best. We think we know who's deserving of love, and we think we know who needs to be shunned or corrected or straightened out. Just like those in the early church knew that Saul of Tarsus was a cruel, worthless, incorrigible human being who would never do the right thing. In Matthew chapter 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, beginning in verse 43, Jesus said, you've heard the law that says, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. In that way, you will be acting as true children of your Father in heaven, for he gives his sunlight to both the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you love only those who love you, what reward is there for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. And if you are only kind to your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. But you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. It's not our place to go around determining who is worthy of compassion and kindness and love. The author of the book called Embracing Obscurity, and it was written anonymously, which is interesting. The individual wrote, "One evening while watering the garden, the sheer sacrifice of true service overwhelmed me." He said, "There among the tomatoes and parsley, I realized that most of my previous attempts at service, serving others in the Lord, were very much like the garden hose in my hand." He said, "I was in control, dictating how, when, and to whom I would serve. With my nifty sprayer, I could even stop the water altogether when I felt like it. The flow of Christ's love that I gave to others depended on my mood, the health of my career, and even how much I slept the night before. Mine was, and still often is," he said, "a self-righteous, self-gratifying service." He writes, "In contrast, I noticed a soaker hose in the planter across from me." That's one of those hoses, round, maybe flat. It's got all kinds of little hoses, perforations in it, little openings, pores. And the water sprays out in a fine mist, and it's indiscriminate. It just goes everywhere. And so he says, "It watered the ground completely indiscriminately. Dozens of holes let the water loose, and it had no shut-off switch. Life-giving water oozed out all over the place, like it or not." He goes on to say that to serve like a soaker hose means to pour out Christ's love from every pore of our beings, not concerning ourselves with the timing, the effect it might have on our productivity, or the worthiness of the recipients. Then he concluded by saying, "If God has turned on the water in our lives, if he's blessed us abundantly, filling us with his life-giving springs, why would we hold them back from anyone else? Would we hold them back from fear of running out of water, running out of grace, running out of love? Doesn't he, that is God, have an infinite supply of living water?" Like many, perhaps we would have withheld the living water from the woman at the well. Maybe we would have withheld the water of life from Saul of Tarsus. But we need to just serve God, like a soaker hose, letting his life-giving water ooze out through the holes or the broken places of our lives. God is looking for under-rowers, those servants, those slaves who know their place, servants who will be faithful to him. Let us determine to be faithful under-rowers, faithful servants as we humbly serve the captain of the ship, the master of the sea, the creator of the universe.